Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
I have to tell you a little funny story before I start my sermon. I was thinking so hard, what am I going to preach? And I wanted to preach a sermon called What's Next? I thought, oh, that would be a title. And I was thinking of all the things I could say. And I thought, Sarah, you're not the minister here. You can't tell them what's next. So I switched gears, and I'm preaching a sermon called Open Hearted. But then I got your newsletter, and I saw that Terry Ellen was coming the week before. So Terry, for those of you who don't know, was my predecessor here for, 14 years, I think, Terry was here. And his sermon title was, What Now? So you almost got a sermon series from your former ministers of What Now and What's Next. But it's very funny.
Whatever.
Okay, Ron. I see it's a calm response congregation now. Well, instead, I actually want to take up a rather tender topic, and that is, how do we remain open-hearted in a time like this one? How do we remain open-hearted when our society is so divided and people are so seemingly angry? How do we maintain this spiritual practice of generosity, of open-heartedness, when there's so much upheaval and tragedy in the world, when there are fires and floods and earthquakes, and police shootings, and racial tension, election anxiety, terrorism, and war? In fact, this place should be a place where we can let down our defenses, right, and experience the power of loving community. But how do we remain open-hearted even here? This challenge presents itself even here, when we are walking with one another through turmoil and change like this congregation has experienced. And in our own lives, we sometimes feel fraught and fragile. And as the poet Mary Oliver says, to remain open-hearted in a world like this is to be willing to be broken-hearted. Is it worth it? Is it worth the risk and the pain? It's easy to be open-hearted in childhood when your world seems secure. I mean, not all of us had the luxury of that kind of start in life, but I did. And it wasn't until college for me that my heart really broke open in the way that Mary Oliver is talking about and could never again close to the world. And what did it for me was a lecture I went to on bombs that burn. I don't know if any of you remember this campaign of Ed Asner, of all people, but it turned out that what I learned is our government was supplying bombs that had a burning chemical in them, which were being used by right-wing rebels in the countryside to intimidate peasant farmers in El Salvador. Our government was paying for these bombs, and children were being burned by these bombs in large numbers. I couldn't believe it. It woke me up. I became an activist. I began marching and organizing like many of you and attending more lectures. And then one day, Dr. Helen Caldicott came to town. Have any of you ever heard her speak? She's the founder of an organization called Physicians for Nuclear Responsibility. And she came to talk about what would actually happen in great detail. Would a nuclear weapon be detonated in a large city? I was stunned. I was amazed. I went and I gathered some of my friends, and we went to hear her again that afternoon. And then I got some more of my friends because I thought everyone should know about this, and we went to hear her for a third time that same evening. I have to tell you, by the time I had listened to that speech for three times in a row, something inside just turned off. I was paralyzed with fear. I was sure that I would be at college, separated from my family and loved ones, a nuclear weapon would be detonated, and there I'd be. I know it sounds funny, but this was real for me at this moment, and I thought it was really possible. These were the Reagan years. There was a lot of tension going on. And I determined back in my dorm that I should never have children because it would be cruel to raise children in a world where they would simply be detonated by a nuclear holocaust. I called my home. I wanted to talk to my mom, and she wasn't home. And there I found my dad. So, even though my dad and I weren't very close or didn't have conversations like this, I told him what was going on, and he listened quietly. I remember feeling that way, he told me, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did some of you live through that? I thought it was going to be the end of the world as we knew it, he told me. And then life did go on, and somehow that was enough. And even though he didn't promise me that we would live happily ever after or that bad things wouldn't happen on large scales, I felt better after talking to my dad and just being listened to and understood. I didn't feel so alone. This is what we can do for one another in our brokenheartedness. And the world has gone on, flawed and imperiled as it is, and sometimes and somehow that has to be enough. I forget now who said this, but I remember reading once in the days of yore before we had cell phones and smartphones and there were payphones all over New York City, that if it was announced that the world was about to end, people would be found running in the streets to phone booths, desperately punching in the numbers of their loved ones and stammering out loud how much they loved each other. It stayed with me, and it shouldn't require imminent planetary destruction for us to finally come out and tell each other, right? But sometimes with so much tension and peril and threat going on, the opposite effect can happen, and we become closed-hearted. We shut down. We close our hearts to each other, and we close our hearts to the cries of the world. Recently, a friend of mine was changing in a sports locker room, and he couldn't help overhearing a man who was being rather loud and bombastic, declaring, "Obama is the worst president we've ever had." "Well," my friend said, "I think he's one of the best presidents we've ever had." "He's made the country more divided than we've ever had it before," yelled the man at my friend. And my friend, now seething with what he thought was racist and reductionist rhetoric, couldn't think of anything else to say to him, so he just came up with a New York hello. "F you," he said. And he left. And luckily it didn't come to blows, but I think this is a good example of where we are at these days. We don't know how to disagree with each other anymore. The tension between people who have one worldview and those with another runs so high that we can't express ourselves rationally with one another. We may as well just stick our fingers in our ears and go, nah, 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 as much as we're actually hearing the other side with their points of view. And of course, I'm referring to the presidential race, but it's only the most obvious current example. It's happening in so many places. People seem, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but they seem impatient and curious and worn thin. Tempers seem easily provoked. People seem skeptical and suspicious and guarded. Conflicts in families and communities and churches are common, and forgiveness can be hard to come by. How many of you are familiar with the words from 1 Corinthians 13 that's so often used in weddings? Have you heard those? "Love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it always protects, it trusts, love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease, or their tongues will just..." You know it. This reading is used so often in weddings, but do you know where it really came from? Paul didn't write these words for a wedding. He was writing a letter to a congregation that was fighting with each other. Church fights, it turns out, are nothing new. They've been going on since religious community was invented. Wherever there are two or more gathered in God's name, there will be a church conflict. I can tell you this from working at the Unitarian Universalist Association. The people of Corinthians were bickering among themselves, and Paul was saying this: "Look, people, even though you think you're speaking in tongues in the language of prophecy, you are nothing but a clanging gong if you aren't speaking in the spirit of love. Not romantic love, not wedding day love, but the more challenging big L love, the love that overcomes all hurt and anger and wrong. Put away your childish ideas that you own the truth," said Paul. "For we each see only as a reflection in a mirror. We see in part until we are able to see face to face and know fully and be known fully, fully inside of a greater whole. This is what Paul was trying to say. But to do what Paul is asking requires a daily practice of open-heartedness, even though it means that our hearts will be broken over and over again, never closed to the rest of the world, imperfect as it is. But really, what is the alternative? If you build up the walls of your heart, you get hardened and cynical and isolated. You choose being right over being happy, and you lose sight of what is possible. And eventually you're going to experience heart failure. So choose open-heartedness. The Quaker educator Parker Palmer puts it this way: heartbreak is an inevitable and painful part of life, but there are at least two ways for the heart to break. It can break open into new life, or it can break apart into shards of sharper and more widespread pain. A brittle heart, he writes, will explode into 1,000 pieces and sometimes get thrown like a fragment grenade at the perceived source of its pain. There's a lot of that going on these days. But a supple heart, he says, will break open into a greater capacity to hold life's suffering and its joy in a way that allows us to say, the pain stops here. The pain stops here. In a few weeks, I'm going to be traveling down to Fort Jackson in South Carolina, where I'm sure it's going to be hot and humid. It's the largest army base in the world. Have any of you actually ever been there? It's an overwhelmingly huge place. It also houses the chaplain training schools for the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. And I will be there attending the graduation of one of my Air Force chaplains. So you may not know this, but since I left Ridgewood and took on the role of overseeing our Ministries and Faith Development staff group at the UUA, which involves a large portfolio, I also became the official endorser of our military chaplains. And they've become sort of my little congregation. I needed a congregation after this one. And I'm tremendously proud of the work that they do in the military. As I speak, we have chaplains, UU ministers, serving in war zones in Afghanistan and Iraq and Kuwait. We have ministers in trauma hospitals like Bagram Air Force Base. We have ministers on board of Coast Guard cutters and in Air Force hangars, and military chaplains leading services this morning and counseling sessions, and even running alongside the Marines in a boot camp setting. Chaplains are technically there because they are there to facilitate the right to the free exercise of religion. But in a deepest sense, they are called to make meaning in the midst of the greatest insanity that we human beings inflict upon ourselves and one another, that insanity being war. Unless we forget, this month marks 25 years that we have continuously been at war as a nation. Unitarian and Universalists have been serving in the military as chaplains since the beginning, it turns out. In fact, the very first chaplain who was commissioned by George Washington was William Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's grandfather. Isn't that amazing? And if you know your Universalist history, the Universalist John Murray, who landed at Barnegat Bay, New Jersey, brought Universalism to our shores in 1770, he was also in the first 20 military chaplains commissioned by George Washington. And when the other chaplains found out that a heretic like him had been commissioned, they were very upset. And they complained to George Washington. And George Washington said to them, "I have commissioned this minister as a chaplain in our army, and you will respect him as such." And so began a very interesting and long experiment in pluralism in the military, which I now find myself challenged to be a part of as well. It's a wonderful ministry. The reason I bring that up is to share a little piece by one of our UU chaplains, George Tiger, that is related to this theme of open-heartedness. And he describes in this how much courage it takes to keep an open heart, even in the midst of war. So as he writes this, he's deployed in Kandahar City and rolling around every day on these essentially large Humvees, visiting different installations and trying to help people keep their spirits up. There's a kind of courage, he writes, that we often forget and don't give ourselves credit for. I call it the courage to care. When you choose to care, you tell the world that despite all the risks, there's some truth larger than ourselves that makes every loss, every grief, and every disappointment worth the risk. Sometimes when nothing makes sense, all we can do is care, and that very act itself brings meaning. So it is that the courage to care may be the greatest courage we can display. It's interesting to note that the root of that word courage is cor dono, or to give one's heart. To what do you give your heart? Having the courage to care means to hold the very heart of one's being open to new and dawning truth, to connection and to loss, and to living into the possibility of greater wholeness for everyone. Here is a story to break your heart. Are you willing? Are you willing to have your heart broken so that the world might enter into the very veins of your being, allowing the greatest love, big L love, to enter into your heart, to occupy you, to occupy your every day? Because this is your choice, every day. Blessings on you, and may it be so.